Hello, friends. This is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. This is the second episode in a series of episodes about how science intersects with our lives in surprising ways. I say intersects because these are not scientific episodes per se, but they aren't scientistic either. Instead, they're about what science can bring into our lives. That could include philosophical questions, connections with others, inner states of peace, and even productive dread. There's a bit of that on this episode. Across this series, we'll be considering the development of the concept of nature, reflections on our own animalistic violence, the truth and complications of the scientific method itself, and the ways in which we connect at the tiniest layers of existence. I started this last episode, episode 260, with Marjolein van Heemstra, who wrote a great book called In Light Years, There's No Hurry, which is all about how cosmic perspectives, seeing the big picture of the universe itself and seeing space differently, can help us meet the challenges of our time. This is a very different episode. It's about animal attacks. This episode is very exciting and interesting for me on many levels, not the least of which is that it's with Wes Larson. Wes is a wildlife biologist, and he is also the co-host of one of the only podcasts I listen to on a regular basis, the Tooth and Claw podcast, which he hosts with his brother Jeff Larson and also Mike Smith. Every week of that show is just like a different horror story where they tell a true story about animals attacking people and also how to deal with an attack if it seems imminent for you, how to avoid them, and they share a bit about the animals too. And it's also very funny, as crazy as that sounds, and somehow at the same time generally manages to be pretty respectful of all parties involved, human and the other animals on the show. I've been a Patreon patron and a longtime listener of Tooth and Claw, so I reached out to them just out of sheer excitement of talking to someone who hosts a podcast I love. And it's funny, when Wes was on, I got kind of nervous. I mean, if you are not new to the show, you know I talk to spiritual leaders, big-time authors, rock stars, etc. And I don't usually get nervous. But for some reason, it was like, oh my gosh, this guy hosts a podcast that I love. So I think maybe it's because we have the same job. It still went really smoothly, I'd say. It was great. But I did have to ask myself ahead of the show, like as any reasonable person might at some point in their lives, if they're into this kind of stuff, why am I so interested in animal attacks? What is it that's so fascinating to me about animals attacking people? So Wes and I talk about that on the show. That's a big part of this episode, why people are drawn into that, and all the stories around them, the survival stories, the science stories, the behavior stories, all that kind of stuff. Maybe it's worth mentioning here that my very first memory is of an animal attack, although it's sort of a strange one, I grant you, because my earliest memory is of a dream. In a dream, I was eaten by a fox, and then that fox was eaten by a wolf, and then that wolf was eaten by a bear. So it was kind of like a fox, wolf, bear, turducken, which would be a... No, I'm not going to even try it. But I woke up from the dream. It was a nightmare for me because I was very young. And I woke up from it, and I just tottered down the hallway to my parents' bedroom, and then I got into bed with them. I remember it. I mean, I must have been very young because I have very early memories, and that is absolutely the earliest one. So my fascination starts, I guess, since before I was even a fully conscious person. What followed in my life is this lifetime obsession with animals. I don't really talk that much about animals on the show, but on this one and the episode after this one too, I will be talking about animals a lot. I was one of those deeply nerdy kids when it came to animals as a result, or I don't know, maybe it's not a result of that dream, but I just was one of those deeply nerdy kids. So like, you know, the kind of kid, it's fifth grade, everybody has to do a science report on an animal. People around me, the other kids are doing reports on elk and ducks and maybe a lion or something. And I'm like, mine is on the civet, the spotted cat-like predator who's actually more closely related to a mongoose. He hangs out in trees, you know, like that kind of nerdy, you know, like you love that kind of stuff about yourself when you're older. When you're a kid, you can be a little isolating. But I also had these things called safari cards. Each card had a different animal on it, and there were all these facts about the animals on the back, and I had all those coming in the mail, and I would just sort them and memorize them. So I was really obsessed with animals. I still am really into them. I have never really been attacked by animals, except, you know, a few cat scratches here and there. But the one animal that did attack me, that really went for me, was my dog when I was a teenager. It was just this weird split moment. We had always, to my knowledge at least, treated the dog really well. Maybe there was someone else in the family who wasn't, but we treated the dog very well. I went outside to pet him. He was a German short-haired pointer, and he just snapped and didn't even like do anything. Like there was no warning. He just lunged forward, bit my hand, and started shaking. Blood was flying everywhere, and then he chased me. My stepmother went to get him, and he chased her too, just like snarling. And then he just calmed down and was back to being ashamed. And that showed me that as much as we can understand animal behavior, there's also this invisible or beyond our observation aspect or capacity to animals. There's always something going on. And that mystery, I think, draws us to the violence when it breaks the surface. What is going on here? Why would an animal do that? And we try to figure it out. And that is something that I think Wes, Jeff, and Mike do a really good job on the show, is figuring out why most attacks did happen. But you never know. Animal attacks on people are, unless the person has provoked the animal, violence where no one is at fault. And I think that's also why they're really alluring to us. In a sense, they are pure violence. They're violence that's embodied, but it's not intended in the same way as when humans exact violence on each other. So it's violence without malice. And I think that's part of the fascination. We talk about that on the episode a lot, but there's so much more to it. I would suggest you subscribe to Tooth and Claw Podcast, give it a listen, see if you like it, if you don't already listen to it, and do support their Patreon. That's patreon.com/toothandclawpodcast. And then also, of course, the other Patreon, this show's Patreon, patreon.com/ConorHabib. If you're a new listener and into science stuff, I have a ton of episodes coming up on it, but also there's a bunch of older episodes, like with conservation expert Michelle Niehaus on episode 156, James Lovelock, who developed the Gaia Theory on episode 171, the scientific origins of sex on episode 92, blended with a little philosophy. And like, even if you want to take things in a really weird direction, some scientific thoughts on paranormal investigation with Greg and Dana Newkirk, who created the Hellier series on episode 46, way back when we met in a hotel room and they brought their possessed doll to hang out. Anyway, so patreon.com/ConorHabib, that's what this show is supported by. I don't have ads. I don't have any sponsors for the show. I like keeping things just as a relationship between my listeners and me and the show. So patreon.com/ConorHabib. Also, please subscribe and leave a warm review and 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. That really helps get the visibility there, and 5-star rating on Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. You can also buy my novel, Hawk Mountain. There's a lot of nature writing in there and quite a bit of violence too, which came out from W.W. Norton in the US and Penguin in Ireland, the UK, and Australia. So it's pretty much available everywhere where you can buy books in English. If you do any of those things, or you've done any of those things already, thank you so much. If not, please do take a minute to pause here and do it. Okay. All right. Thanks. Here we go. Hey there, Wes. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Okay. So I'm going to start off with a really basic question, which is, I kind of know the answer, but what is a wildlife biologist? And I know like that should be kind of like
well, everybody should know that, especially I have a science education. But the thing is, you go to a lot of different projects, and that's the thing that's kind of throwing me. Like, I would assume that you would be in one area, or really, I mean, I guess you are most closely studying bears, but like, it seems like you do a lot of different kind of wildlife projects. So that's throwing my idea of what I think a wildlife biologist usually does. So I'm just going to start there.
Yeah. You know, I don't think there's really necessarily like guide rails for exactly what a wildlife biologist is. I've been really lucky in my career that I have been able to work on so many different projects. And part of that is luck. And part of that is me emphasizing experiences over pay. So I think if you're a biologist that's just really looking to move up the ladder and kind of get paid a bit more, you tend to focus on one thing and you stay in that same spot and you just work your way up in whatever organization you're working for. And then you don't really get the amount of different experiences, but you are going to probably work up that ladder a lot quicker. For me, I wanted to spend more time in the field and I wanted to do it with various species. So I took a lot of different jobs that really didn't pay well at all, but I was able to be on the field a lot and work with a lot of animals. So I think that's kind of why I bounced around so much. I also had some really unique opportunities that came as a direct result of social media and just having a large following and being able to share that with people. And then I as far as like what a wildlife biologist is, it's a good question. I would just say a wildlife biologist is someone who studies the biology of wildlife. It's someone who, you know, learns the habits, the movement patterns, the behaviors, the ecology, the natural history of wildlife. And then typically biologists do either research or management. So research would be learning about those things, producing academic journals or papers that will be put in journals. And adding to that growing knowledge base of the animals. And then managers will take those things that they're learning from the literature or from, you know, whatever other sources, and then they go out and actually put different things into place to manage the wildlife, to manage wild populations. So,
yeah. Well, so first of all, I mean, it's funny that like you're the only biologist whose podcast supports their like biology habit. You know, I mean, I know it's your job, but like, yeah, it's actually afforded you to do different kinds of biology, which is pretty great. But I also think,
totally,
I mean, for me, obviously we'll talk plenty about animal tax, but for me, one of the things that's so cool about your show is that it's about animal behavior. And I think when I was in school, one of the most frustrating things for me, because I studied organismic and evolutionary biology in grad school. And my professor, Lynn Margulies, she would always say, like, there's no life in biology anymore. Like, what we're doing with organismic biology is putting the bio back in the biology, because it's so much of it's like molecular biology now. And it's really reducing organisms down and down and down into things that almost become like just completely quantitative or just like equations or whatever. But you get a completely different view when you're studying behavior and morphology and all that. And it seems like for me, that's something that's really vitalizing about listening to your show. I mean, it's funny and it's fun and all that kind of stuff, but also like, it really gives me a sense of nature in a way that biology very often doesn't. Like, to be frank.
No, and even in wildlife biology, a lot of my colleagues, what they work on more is like modeling, statistics. There, a lot of wildlife biologists have to learn how to be coders too, because they're using these really complicated stats models and programs that, to be like totally frank with you, I was always terrible at that aspect of wildlife biology. Uh-huh. And that's probably another part of why I kind of was like, you know, I'm just going to stick to field work because that's what I'm good at. Uh-huh. I'm good at observing behaviors and that sort of thing. But actually like making them, you know, quantifying them is a little bit trickier. So I agree with you. I think there is a lot that's been lost in that shuffle. And when people ask me, you know, if I could go back in any time, I think I'd want to be in like the 1920s or 30s and be a biologist where you can just go to the Arctic and say, oh, polar bears eat seals, you know, and you can produce a paper on that. And nowadays it's like, oh, what's in their mitochondria that makes them want to eat seals? So it's just, it's very tricky.
Yeah. Well, I like also that it's basically like, yeah, Wes isn't good at math, so let's throw him into like the danger zone. It's basically what happened. I totally get it. I actually resonate so much more with that. And I think, you know, that was how my mentor learned, was by going to University of Chicago. And it was like the science education was completely different because you would learn the history of science at the same time as you were learning science. And I also think that like probably most people who aren't in the sciences think that that's what what you do is what biology mostly would be with animals, and it's not. And yeah. I'm obviously disparaging, like you probably have a much kinder view of it than I do, because I find it really frustrating. No, you don't. Okay.
No, and sometimes I feel bad because I do get a lot of people that reach out saying like, oh, you have the coolest job, you know, I want to do what you do. And I usually say, okay, you know, you're going to be broke. And you also probably aren't going to be able to do what I do. You know, like I do feel like, and I'm not saying that because I feel like I'm exceptional. I just got really lucky. And most biologists end up working maybe with a species that's a little less sexy than bears and spend a lot of time in the lab or in the office. So yeah, it's not always quite as appealing as it looks on Instagram.
Well, I mean, that was part of like also when I was an undergraduate, I really wanted to be an entomologist and actually kind of wanted to be a myrmecologist, like studying ants. And I realized that I could never do it because mostly what people do when they're entomologists is pest control. And I just thought like, fuck, like that is completely the opposite of why I'm interested in this.
You know? Totally. Yeah. I mean, most of the bear managers in Montana these days spend their time trapping and killing bears just because they're getting into trouble. So often you have to do stuff you don't want to do when you get into these kind of fields.
I think a lot of the rise of evolutionary psychology was also really frustrating for me, which it comes up sometimes on the show, but not almost ever. Like you don't really talk about human behaviors in terms of evolutionary explanations, which I also find like, that's really pop sciencey, and you guys don't really do that much.
Yeah, I part of that's probably just because I don't know too much about it. I mean, my focus has all been on wildlife, and my master's was on human wildlife conflict, so I definitely did have to bring in that human side of things, but not really get into the studies of human evolution or any of that sort of thing. So, I don't know if that was so much a conscious choice or just something that happened out of ignorance.
Or something that was driven by evolution. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, as far as that conflict goes, it's funny because like in Ireland, we do have obviously, you know, kind of confrontations between human and animals, but there are no dangerous animals here at all, which is...
Yeah.
As an American moving here, the biggest mindfuck, and I have friends who are from Australia who live here, and I mean, it's even weirder for them that you can basically walk around with your bare feet in pitch blackness. I mean, you might sink into a bog or get a tick or something like that, but you would never get, there's no danger from the natural world at all.
And it's unfortunate for me. I've been asked this question a lot, like, and this kind of ties into that whole thought of, people often ask me why I study bears, like why bears were the thing that I got into. And for me, it's exactly because of what you said, that when you don't have an animal like a bear or a mountain lion or a jaguar or something like that, a big alpha predator in an ecosystem, it becomes very tame, or even just like venomous snakes, like anything like that. You just suddenly feel like, for me at least, and this isn't everyone, and I'm glad this isn't everyone, when I'm out in nature and I don't have that, I feel like I'm in a park. I feel like I'm in a very controlled environment where I don't really have to pay attention to my surroundings. And when I don't pay attention to my surroundings, I kind of miss a lot. I feel like I'm not getting the full experience. But meanwhile, if I'm hiking in grizzly country, I'm looking at every single hillside. I'm looking at every single part of my environment. I'm smelling things. Everything just is stronger and more intense because I have to be at that level. And it increases the whole experience for me. And so, I don't know, it's unfortunate that's happened in places, but also, I don't know, I'm sure there's plenty of people that live in Ireland that love that it's that way.
Well, I just don't think they think about it. I mean, the main thing you would worry about is a bull, honestly, in a field. Like, you'd be worried that you'd be taking a walk and the bull would show up, or maybe a ram or something like that. But we had wolves here, and I'm sure at a certain point we probably had bears. But even the sharks, I mean, they're basking sharks. We don't have, like, as someone tried to convince me the other day that they could swallow you. What's that?
Big filter feeding sharks.
Yeah, just like the big gaping mouth. And we did have like a few hammerhead shark sightings, and we have orcas here and stuff. But I mean, that's all a stretch. You know what I mean?
And there's blue sharks out there too, I think. But yeah, beautiful sharks. I would kill to see a basking shark. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Well, it's very like, I guess I was thinking of it in terms of, you know, the conflict that people have here. There is conflict, but it's mostly what you would expect anywhere. We have rats, we have rat problems. We have like declining populations of certain animals. I moved here from LA, and there were black widow spiders all over where I lived in LA. And there were, you know, obviously the other stuff, mountain lions and coyotes
black
and
bears.
Yeah. And, I think it's just like the funny difference where I'm constantly catching myself, where I'm like, oh, you don't have to be afraid. You don't have to be afraid. So already like my haunches are up, but I do get to look at the landscape a little bit more, I would say. So like, maybe that's the thing. It's like, maybe the vistas are getting lost for you because you have to know what the sounds around you are or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. And for me, again, I think when I do have to pay attention to that sort of thing, I feel like I take those vistas in even more so.
I've
never lived in a place that doesn't have at least one of those animals or something that can hurt me.
There's actually not, I mean, I can't even really think of another place that's like Ireland, to be honest. I mean, there are cities, but I can't really think of a place that has no dangerous animals at all.
I feel like the United Kingdom is kind of, but
yeah,
it's uniquely tamed.
Yeah. You know, the question of the why of people being attracted to animal attacks, rather than just ask you that question, I tried to figure out what it was for me and why you guys are the only podcast I really listen to. And I have to just be honest, because, you know, when you do podcasts, you still like them, but it's just like, all right, you know, you have limited scope for them. So
totally.
I really thought about why have I listened to every fucking episode of this show? And I think it's because it's violence, but no one's wrong. I mean, you guys go into like why people are wrong, but no one's really done anything to anybody. Of course, there are these like exceptions on the show, but there are mistakes, but that's all it is. And I think it might be actually a way for me to think about or think through violence or aggression or something like that.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Like, it's not like a typical true crime show in that there's not this human nightmare. You know, there is a nightmare that's very human, but it's not out of any kind of ill will or evil or whatever. It's just natural behavior. But yeah, I think that's a really good question. I tend to take it to a human evolutionary standpoint. So here we go. And there's actually a quote by E.O. Wilson that I just absolutely love. And I have it here. He says, "We are not afraid of predators. We're transfixed by them, prone to weave stories and fables and chatter endlessly about them, because fascination creates preparedness, and preparedness survival in a deeply tribal way. We love our monsters." Which is like, honestly, one of the quotes that made me start this podcast. When I read that, I was kind of like, you know what? people really are just so fascinated with predators. And I do think it comes from this primal place deep inside of us that throughout humankind, throughout our history, we've talked about these things and they've been these things hiding in the shadows. And I think, you know, talking about dangerous wildlife is one way we do it. Watching horror movies is the way we do it. It's just something inside of us is fascinated by things that can hurt us or things that are more powerful than us. And I really do think that dates all the way back to when we came out of trees and we were worried about leopards that were stalking us in high grass. So for me, I just think it's just something deep, deep, deep inside of most of us. There's an episode, I think it was Radiolab, where they talked about this exact thought and how when something flies across the sun, we have the instinct to look up. And they trace that back to early man. And they think that one of our main predators were these large birds of prey. And that instinct of like something flying over the sun has triggered, you know, we still have this reaction to kind of look because of that, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of maybe worrying about, maybe not hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of years of worrying about death from above. And we are getting into pop evolutionary psychology, I guess, but but it is interesting to me. It's fascinating to think about why that kind of stuff is still so rooted in our psyches.
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to take that would be maybe just to talk about what it would feel like to have a natural predator again that was actually like consistently feeding on us. Although there's that that David Quammen book, Monsters of God, where he talks about people that were just constantly fed on by the lions in India, I think it was, and there were the tigers as well. The tiger, what's that tiger that killed like 400? I'm going to get it wrong.
But
it was
like the Champawat tiger.
Yeah, you guys talked about like some insane amount where I always like ask people, now I can't remember the number, but I'm always like, what's the highest number that, you know, any tiger has killed? And I guess maybe I give them the wrong answer because I don't remember it right now.
It's 400 something.
Yeah, it's 400 something, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot of people. I haven't eaten that many people. But so there probably are some people that live in close proximity there's enough engagement that actually that there is the presence of a natural predator. And I think that's kind of what David Coleman was trying to investigate maybe with that book. It's a great book. Yeah, I don't know
I ordered it yesterday.
Oh, it's so good, man.
It's kind of fun you bring it up because last night a friend was like, you should order this book. So I did. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a big hit when it came out, but he wasn't as famous as he is now because he was, you know, he wrote about viruses and stuff like that. And obviously that catapulted a lot of people to fame the past few years. But so like maybe that's one direction that I would think about is what it actually would feel like to have the presence of a constant predator. I mean, I guess you actually kind of feel like that though in your daily life because you just talked about the landscape being that way. So like, let's imagine we all feel like that. What's that like,
Wes? Well, I think there's a big difference though between the way that I get to experience that and feel that than like someone in rural India or one of those places. Because for me, it's kind of this exciting, exhilarating thing, but I have the safety of my home. I can kind of like dictate how much I want to interact with that animal based on how much I go hiking, how much I enter their environment. And these places where those environments overlap, I think it's very different from this kind of like, oh, this is exciting. We get to have this primal experience. It's more of a, I would much rather not have to deal with this on a daily basis. You know, I think of people in the Sundarbans in India where, you know, there's 50 tiger deaths a year. And those people live in constant fear. It's not a fun thing for them. And it does make you understand a little bit more of the perspective of let's get rid of this animal, which obviously I'm deeply against that idea. Mm. But I do feel like if I lived in a place like that, it might sink in a little bit more like, hey, my life would be much better if I didn't have to deal with this monster. And they're obviously not monsters. I'm just saying that's how I think that's easy to view it that way if you do live in that situation. But for me, kind of switching gears, again, it's, for me, it's exhilarating. It's something that gives me kind of, it's exactly what I need as a person to have that kind of wilderness that's accessible to me. Because it does make me feel more alive, and it makes me feel like I have to just be a little bit more attentive to my life, to the world, to everything. And that increases my quality of life. So, yeah, I think there's definitely different perspectives.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because I think in a way, you know, just thinking about animals attacking people, in some ways they exemplify kind of freedom. I mean, it's not necessarily freedom I'd want to access if I really had it, where, you know, you're driving behind someone and you're like, I'll fucking kill you if you don't speed up, or just like, you know, wanting to just like, you know, like go after someone. And everybody has thoughts like that, but seeing animals do it, it's interesting to me because in some ways I don't, oh, maybe actually we'll disagree here. I don't know, but like, I wouldn't say that they exactly have free thinking or free will in the same way that we do. I'm not saying that they don't have any like volition or autonomy, but in other words, I'm looking at something that's like highly, is compulsive the right word, but it has its behaviors. Yeah. And those have a deep pattern that human beings don't seem to have, but I'm looking at them and feeling actually a sense of freedom. Maybe it's either like freedom from the responsibility of making a choice, or maybe it's freedom to make whatever kind of choice you want. You don't like this person, kill him. You really like this person, eat him, you know, like whatever it might be. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the better word would be instinctual. They're highly instinctual. And I do think we are much more able to suppress and control our instincts. Because you're right. Like if we just acted on every instinct we have, there'd be a lot more violence and chaos in the world. But I think with animals, you know, and this gets into kind of a part of biology that's almost impossible to say, you know, fact and fiction. But as far as I think, I feel like animals do tend to act much more on their instincts than humans do. But that doesn't mean they're bound by them. You know, I there's just such a large suite of behaviors in any given species that it's hard to kind of say, oh, they all act as this block, and they all kind of, if you do A, they do B. And that's something we have to be really careful about on the podcast, because I can say, listen, if a black bear comes at you and you get really loud and throw things at it, it's going to run away. And 99, you know, times out of 100, or 99.9 times out of 100, that's true. But that one bear that's just like, nah, you know, this doesn't bother me at all, and I actually want to see if this is food, it's going to do that. And it's not going to act the way that those other black bears do. And so you really have to, for us, we have to tell people like, okay, here's the predictable behavior, but just so you know, there could be that bear that's completely unpredictable. And that's why you need to take the preparations to prepare to like arm yourself for that kind of interaction. So, yeah, it's tricky.
I mean, I think people accept that when it's kind of the other way around, where like, well, I don't know, maybe they don't accept it. But when someone has like a tame or quote unquote, which is impossible, I understand, like domesticated bear, and then it attacks its owner, people are like, well, yeah, of course. Like, why would you get a bear? Right. Like, but even with dogs, you know, my own dog attacked me when I was a kid. And I mean, that was just terrifying experience. And he was such a nice dog up to that point. And it was not a breed that was, it was a German short-haired pointer. And like, just one day just grabbed my hand and shook it. And I do maybe want to ask about dogs, if you guys are going to do dog episodes at any point, but
yeah, we will.
Okay.
That's going to be a tricky one, because that and like, this is a little side tangent obviously, but I think that's going to be our episode where we get the most feedback. And
of course, are you doing pit bulls, or are you just doing dogs?
That's the thing. That's what I was about to say, is it's probably going to be really pit bull heavy. And and that, obviously, it's a breed that has a lot of people that are really fighting for them. And I applaud those people, but they're also just physically capable of a lot, lot more than some other breeds of dog.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, and they do have some behavioral attributes that need to be kind of, you know, tamped down if you're a pit bull owner. And so I think it's a human problem, not a dog problem. I think there's people that get pit bulls that aren't ready for them.
Yeah.
And that's the main issue. But yeah, that's going to be a tricky one.
I mean, I think it's good to be honest about these kinds of things, you know? Yeah. I know part of it is like, isn't it? It's true, isn't it, that Chihuahuas probably attack more people than pit bulls or like lots of other breeds of dogs, but they just can't.
Right.
They can maybe snap a fingertip off, but that's about it. Yeah, exactly. But yeah. I mean, it is good to be honest about these things. I mean, sometimes though, when I listen to the show, I do sometimes think, I don't mean this as a slight at all. It's just my emotional response to the show where I'm just like, but it does like give a little bit more of a sense that like, they don't really ever want to go for us. You know,
we try to illustrate that there's different types of conflict that happen between humans and animals. So like, for example, a grizzly bear here in Montana, if you get mauled by a grizzly bear, more often than not, it's a defensive kind of thing where you have irritated that bear. It's just trying to neutralize you, and then it's going to get away. And that neutralizing can be anything from a swat where you fall back and you're fine to like a full-on mauling where you're probably not going to survive. So that's one option. And that's kind of speaking to what you're saying, like, okay, if I'm really careful, if I make a lot of noise, if I carry bear spray, if I do all these things, I can greatly reduce my chances of grizzly bear attack. And you're right. And that is kind of like telling people like, you know, grizzly bear is just minding its own business and we need to be smart about how we interact with them. On the other hand, we just did a story about a leopard in India in the 1920s. And that leopard decided to specialize in eating human beings. Like that leopard decided, this is what I'm going to get good at hunting. And they got really fucking good at it. It killed 125 people. It pulled them out of their homes. I mean, it learned our habits. It learned that people would go relieve themselves at night and it would lie in wait and eat those people. And that's an animal that no matter what kind of preparations those people are doing to discourage it, it's still going to go for human beings. And so I do think you're right that there are these kind of outliers in the natural world where an animal decides to purposely interact with humans on a violent level. And those are the most interesting ones to me. But I think if you paint wildlife with that brush and you say wildlife is violent towards humans, it's more often the opposite, where they want nothing to do with us. And that is why we lean into that message a lot more on the podcast.
I mean, it's just a hard audience problem, isn't it? Because like, I mean, you definitely don't want to, right? Like you don't want to fuel people going out and killing animals, because they're hearing these stories or be afraid to go outside or whatever, right. Like stoke the fear. So it's kind of like, well, I mean, your audience is really big. I'm sure it's actually quite varied. You can't necessarily know who's going to land where on which side. I mean, for me, I kind of know who my audience is, but I mean, not fully. They're pretty varied too, but like, I wouldn't ever have that kind of problem. Like I might have to like watch myself that I say something that doesn't give someone the wrong political or like spiritual view or something like that, but it's not going to incite people to like go murder any animals. But then I do think like, sometimes when I listen, like, so how do I break this down? So the Wolverine episode you did, you know, you prefaced it. You were like, oh, look, there's no real like recorded instances of this, but here's this anecdotal story of, you know, a pretty aggressive encounter with a Wolverine. When I think about the kind of overall like arc of the show, it's usually based on cases that are recorded, usually based on being able to find what specific behaviors. But then I sometimes do think like, well, there's a lot of anecdotal stories that might actually not be playing into these. One, because the people died, and or two, because there's like some sort of cultural prohibition for you getting like actually getting that data. So like my father grew up in Syria in like a little village in mountains, basically. And there were hyenas And then he lived in a village, so they had a home, but there were like traveling people in the area too. And their stories were that the hyenas would like kill kids. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that that's, on the one hand, probably not a regular occurrence. But if I were to ask someone, you know, who did biology, like, should we worry about hyenas? And be like, well, you know, don't really like approach them or get close to them, but they're not going to like mostly go for you or whatever. And so I guess my question, is this forming into a question? Yeah, it's forming into a question. Is like, you know, that line between saying that, one, there's the line between the anecdotal evidence and what you allow in as like what counts as evidence, but two, also how that defines or gives you a portrait of the animal that, you know, whose behaviors you're trying to describe or whose encounters you're trying to describe with people. I think that
I can see it. I can see, yeah, what you're getting at.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
thanks for rolling with it.
Yeah, first of all, you know, you bring up the example of a hyenas and it makes me think of wolves. So in the United States, we have one recorded wolf death in mm-hmm. all of history, you know, written history of us interacting with this animal. So in 2010, I believe, is a woman who was out jogging at night in Alaska. She got killed by a pack of wolves, or maybe early morning. That's it. I mean, this is an animal that we've been afraid of for a very long time. And that's the only death that we have on our recorded history in the United States. If you go over to India, the exact same animal, Canis lupus, there are multiple people killed every single year by wolves. It happens quite a bit. And that's just a behavioral difference between the same animal in different parts of the world where it might live. So the reason I bring this up is for each of these species, there's a lot of nuance. And it's really tricky as a podcaster talking about an animal like a wolf or a hyena or a leopard or a puma to say, here is a rule that you can use across the range of this species that's going to keep you safer. Because honestly, if you are dealing with a puma in Patagonia versus a puma in California,
right. Yeah,
it's a very different animal that you're dealing with. And so what I try to do on the podcast is give the people the high level kind of rule that's going to do, you know, it's going to protect them regardless of where they might see that animal. So, you know, with a mountain lion or a puma, that rule is to be really loud and aggressive when you might see one. And you know what? If you see it in Patagonia, you could probably walk up to it and it's not going to attack you. Mm-hmm. But that rule is still going to work. And so that's kind of, I think sometimes you might get that impression of like, oh, you know, Wes is talking about this animal like it's really benign or it's maybe not nearly as dangerous as it needs to be. And I think the reason for that is that it's impossible to talk about every single animal across its range in every single pocket where it inhabits. But when it comes to the safety aspect of our podcast, I'm really conservative. I like to say, you know what? This is probably an animal that's never going to mess with you. But if it does, here's what you need to do.
Yeah.
And I think for us, that to get back to what we were talking about right before, it's empowered a lot of people. We have a big listener base at this point, and we have countless messages from people saying, I used to be nervous to go out into bear habitat. And now with bear spray and with this knowledge that I have, I feel a lot better about it. And weirdly, it took hearing people being dismembered by a bear to give me that kind of confidence. And it's honestly the thing that I'm most proud of when it comes to this is just that we're giving people tools to interact safely with wildlife, and then they can enjoy wildlife and they can develop this passion for wildlife rather than just have fear.
Yeah. I remember, like, I don't know, I think you're younger than me, but like when just before I would go to get my driving license, they used to have like the videos they would show of people getting into car accidents.
Oh, no, I saw those.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm 40, so we're probably.
Yeah, I'm 46. Yeah. Yeah. So it's okay. Just like one all of right. the, that no, approach is effective. Yeah.
It is. And we really have to figure out, it's a tricky balance of like what level of gore and everything you can put in these kind of stories without being disrespectful to the people that we're talking about. But it just like for your other question about, you know, anecdotal stuff, when I research these things, the more intense stuff usually makes it into the podcast because that is what grabs people. And so even if it's anecdotal, if I can get any kind of source for it, I tend to try and bring it up just because it's more interesting. Mm-hmm. And, but I do try and put it in kind of the right shelf, tell people, you know, this is anecdotal. This is something I just read and I don't have a good backup for it.
I mean, it's just such an interesting dimension of when you were studying wildlife human encounters, like of the human side of things is like how people tell stories about that kind of stuff. And you, I mean, you bring it in when you bring in mythology every once in a while, or like the sort of local or communal stories about stuff. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just kind of did that with my Syrian relatives, and the striped hyena is what I meant to say.
Striped hyena.
But, yeah. but I do think it's like, that also is very region specific. And I just find that like, it's just opening up something for me, which is really interesting, which is how do people in different regions tell stories about how to survive these animal attacks, or potential animal attacks, and how those come out versus like what happens in the US and the way people talk about it. Because obviously, you know, in the US there are indigenous people have all sorts of different stories of how to deal with and encounter animals that would be different than people who are, you know, Western settler people. And the culture itself contains completely different relationships, and so therefore would contain completely different like kinds of ways of managing and mediating conflict and heading it off or inspiring it, I suppose, if you want to.
Mm. Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's one that, I always try and tread lightly with those sort of things, because I think there's this whole wealth of indigenous knowledge when it comes to wildlife that, you know, tragically has been kind of pushed down and people don't really try and access it the same way. And these are the people that have always been the best stewards of their wildlife, that have, you know, often made their environments even more kind of biodiverse and rich and everything than they would be naturally. But when it comes to attacks, sometimes that can be a bit of a two-edged sword. It can be a little tricky depending on how information is passed in those societies. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, there's a story that I think of quite a bit of an Inuit gentleman who had the misfortune of being attacked twice by a polar bear, two different completely separate circumstances. And the first time the bear came at him, he had a rock, and he had always heard that what you do is you stand still, the bear comes at you, and right when it lunges at you, you turn sideways and hit it on the head with the rock, and that's the best way to discourage it. And he did this and it worked. The second time
I would have never guessed that. That actually sounds like a Jeff answer almost. Like it's really intense.
It's bad advice, it is, you know. And like, and I that's hard for me to say, but it is like, that's not a good way to handle a polar bear attack. The second time he was attacked, he was killed. And, so for me, it's like in some of those cultures where stuff has been passed down mostly through, you know, verbal transmission or whatever, there's not this synthesis of, they don't have the ability to look back at every single instance where that animal's interacted with humans and pull out these lessons necessarily. They're kind of like one-off instances. And sometimes then those responses can be flawed. But that's, I'm pointing out a very specific circumstance here.
Sorry to interrupt, but I understand also that people are probably also, if they're in small communities, if they're not traveling, then they probably are used to encountering certain bears as well. And those certain bears may even be known better through their behaviors and what's expected of them and how the interaction should go. And so it is telling them about those specific bears, but then as a broad rule just can't be applied. And you're actually kind of saying the same thing about the scientific knowledge or the more science-based knowledge that you're offering for these strategies. Well, sometimes it's going to be bad advice, even if it's good advice, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in just about every way, the Western world is a poorer model when it comes to interacting with the natural world. But I think one way that we, you know, have done a really good job is this ability to compile data across, you know, the ages and pull out lessons from that data. And for a tax, at least, that's a very useful tool to have.
Has that led to like a really surprising piece of advice for you where you're like, whoa, I would have never expected that that's what you should do with this animal?
I'm sure it has. I'm having trouble like pulling one off the top of my head.
Okay.
But there's definitely been stuff that I've researched for the podcast specifically where there's some sort of indigenous knowledge that people weren't privy to that they then learn and it like works perfectly with whatever animal. But it's hard for me to just like think of that off the top of my head. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a funny one, like kind of an interesting one is that, is our relationship with piranha, because we see piranha as these like voracious schools of fish that can clean you to the bone in seconds. And that is largely perpetuated by this myth that was kind of a prank by indigenous people on Western colonizers, where Teddy Roosevelt went and visited this village in the Amazon, and they essentially put all these piranha in a pen and starved them so that when Teddy Roosevelt showed up and they let a cow into this area, it was cleaned by these piranha. And he was just like, holy shit, what is this crazy devil fish?
Yeah.
And it was just kind of a joke by these people and an ichthyologist that lived with them. So, yeah, so I don't funny, know. It's a good question.
But I mean, it's really funny that when I listen to that episode, it's one of my favorite ones, but it's one of the reasons why it's my favorite is because you flip flop so many times, like back and forth between, you're like, do they eat people? Do they not eat people? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it exactly? But with Teddy Roosevelt, because also he's the person he's responsible for us getting this like really frightful picture of piranhas, but then also partially responsible for us getting like a really cuddly, cute picture of bears. Like he's some weird, like distorting prism, you know, you like put it in relation to an animal and people just get the wrong idea.
Yeah. He's an interesting dude. He definitely had a unique relationship with wildlife.
I was thinking about, there's another book called The Red Hourglass. Do you know this book by Gordon Grice? No. So mm-mm. Gordon Grice also wrote a book on animal tax. So that was like my go-to book before you guys had like a podcast, although there's lots of contradictory information between his book and your show. And I defer mostly to your show because it's updated, first of all, but in this book, The Red Hourglass, it's kind of cruel, but it's also very interesting. Basically he gets like two kinds of usually invertebrates and he just puts them in a cage together and sees like, he puts them in a little, you know, like a spider and a mantid or something like that. And he sees what happens. And, there are all sorts of things in that book that are like really excellent, but I was just thinking about that gladiatorial impulse, like why we want to see in the arena. So it's not about a person versus an animal, but that constant like mulling over who's more powerful or who would win or whatever. And Gordon Grice is actually doing that. I mean, at the scale you could do it, probably really horrible if you did it with other animals. I'm not sure ethically how I feel about it being the insects, but I mean, they might encounter each other anyway. And
that's a whole other question.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also wondering about that impulse. Like why that is that we're so interested in understanding that kind of conflict. I guess one, because it just doesn't happen mostly. Sometimes it happens, like I suppose with the jaguars and the caimans and that kind of stuff, but not really.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I like, for me, my knee jerk is just like, oh, because it's cool.
Right.
It's well, cool, right, to think of like these animals fighting. It's crazy. But I don't know what that's rooted in. Like, I don't know if that's an ego thing or like our desire for power, or it's like seeing things that are more powerful than us battle, you know. I really don't know. Like, that's a hard one. But it's an interesting part of our show, because I think when we started it, our idea was to do like pretty much every animal versus the other animals that we had already talked about. So we just brought up leopards for our first time in the show. So if we were to stick to our initial pattern, we'd have to like match a leopard up against every single animal we've done. And we've kind of had to change that to like, okay, what animals would it match up best against? So like, you know, a mountain lion, a chimpanzee. There's a few animals that are in that leopard's weight class that I think is going to be a pretty good fight. But it's tricky because when you are talking about those kind of things, there's so many things that come into play. And I think our knee jerk is to say who's stronger, who's faster, who's all these things. But also you have to consider intelligence. You have to consider behaviors, like natural behaviors. So, you know, where a leopard might not be as physically strong as a chimpanzee, it hunts better than a chimpanzee might, you know. There's these kind of like, and I don't actually know about that one. That's a tricky one. But there's these, all these questions that come into play. And it's, you may have noticed if you've listened to the whole podcast, that's a category we do a lot less than we used to.
Yeah. Cause there's always a clear winner. Like there's always, it's now it's just like, well, killer whales if it's in the water and
Yeah. And like a Siberian tiger if it's on land.
Yeah.
But even within those weight categories, it's just really, it's a hard one. And that's one that people really glom onto. Like, I don't know how many times I've been sent the question of gorilla versus grizzly bear, like thousands. I can't
really?
Like, people like direct messages of people saying, hey, I'm in a fight with my coworkers. I need to know who would win between.
Yeah, I'm in a fight with a gorilla and I'm a grizzly bear. Yeah, what should I do?
Exactly. Yeah. Am I going to win this fight? And it's, I don't know why that's captured people's attention so much, especially recently, but it has, and it's a really, it is interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just lately though. I mean, that's what, I guess the gladiatorial arenas were.
You
just
exactly.
Like, put them in there and be like, let's see what happens. And I mean, obviously people had a very different view of animals back then. I'm sure it still happens in some places, but back then, you know, when it was done more widespread in the classical world, but the desire to see that is really strong. And that's really like, that's kind of puzzling to me. I'm not exactly sure what that's about. I feel it. I'm definitely not above it. Like, I mean, I wouldn't do that to, you know, especially mammals or something like that, but there is some deep fascination with seeing who had went out. It's very strange. And maybe it's like something about the capabilities of each, because in some ways it's actually like a reproduction also of your like ice powers versus tree powers thing. It's just another version of that. Like, what capacity is stronger or more important, you know? Yeah.
And I mean, like, I think you're right that this goes back throughout antiquity, but I think for us that grew up at the time that we did, we also grew up, you know, with video games where you have one person versus another.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
You fight, and you have all these different, like, all these examples of things where we're pitting one thing against another. And maybe that just speaks to our violent nature as humans or what, but it also like weirdly brings up these YouTube videos that have really caught on. And I'm not going to name names, but like these YouTube influencers that go out and need to get stung or bit by all these different things and show which is worse. And they are fascinating. Like I have to access those videos for episodes sometimes. And I do find myself then watching like four or five of them because I'm like, oh yeah, what happens when he gets bit by a piranha? What happens when he gets stung by a tarantula wasp, you know? But it's kind of like, it's very base for me. It feels like you're just appealing to that violence. And sorry, this is a whole different tangent.
But no, you're please.
You know, as someone who loves entomology, you're stressing an animal out to do that to a very high level.
Yeah.
And you're making it expend a very precious resource to do that too. And I think if there's an educational component to what you're producing to do that, great. But if you're just doing it for like clicks or likes or whatever, then you're kind of being a little exploitative, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it irritates me from an animal welfare perspective, I suppose. This just irritates me like from like what kind of person that is. I think that's the thing that's more frustrating. I'm like, why are you, what's happening here? So like you said, it's for the clicks and likes. Anybody doing it for the clicks and likes mostly just fucking irritates me, you know? So this is this extra level where I'm like, okay, it's this dumb, like, jackass for science. You know, I'm not like, yeah. I can't deal with it. But it, as far as the animals being stressed out, it is like, I mean, animals, I love that you did that animal, like, what are animals experiencing episode. I don't know how that went. I don't know if that went over well with the people that were listened to it or whatever, but I really yeah. like that episode as like a little sort of inside, but, you know, thinking about how animals experience the world outside of just their senses. I mean, they really are their emotions, you know? So if I try to think mm-hmm. about what an animal, you know, maybe a dog is probably the worst example because they're so close to human beings, but like a dog wagging its tail, that's not a sign of happiness. Like, that is happiness in the dog. It's actually embodied. Its embodiment is the emotion that it's expressing, this intense emotive state. And in some animals, that emotive state switches on and off. Like a dog that's lying there and completely sleepy can just like bound up and like be into, you know, the mood of happiness right away. A cat will take like a little bit longer to sort of rouse, you know, so you can see the differences, but I can't imagine being stressed out by a human being if your entire being is really emotion related. Yeah. It's got to be like, I mean, that's a really horrible thing to do because they can't even yeah. think about the emotions and consider them. They're just in it. You know, they just are it.
Totally. Like we have the ability to stress animals out to the point where they die, you know, and that's yeah. not, yeah. that happens a lot. It happens more than you might think. And I'm always really careful when I'm talking about animal emotions, because I think you bring up some interesting points where like dogs and cats are animals that are part of our society now. Mm-hmm. And we can recognize emotions because we have that kind of relationship with them. But outside of measuring like cortisol levels and seeing, you know, exactly what an animal is experiencing, like on a hormonal level, it's really tricky for us to say like bears experience happiness when they're doing whatever, or they're, I think there's a few things that are really easy for us to pull out, like anger, or, you know, like, like ecstasy if they're like mating or something like that. I think there's like a few things that we can say that bear is experiencing that. But outside of that, it's really tricky. And so that's why I think it's important that as we interact with wildlife, we do tread lightly, because we don't have that kind of ability to know what animals are experiencing on an emotive level. It makes me think of there's this meme that's recently been out a lot, and people send it to me all the time. Again, it's kind of a tricky one where it's this bear sitting and it's looking out and it's like, oh, scientists think that bears like actually sit and enjoy the beauty of their environments because we've seen them sitting and staring out. And it's like, listen, bears live in beautiful places and they have to look somewhere, you know, like a bear is going to sit sometimes and it's going to look. It has to point its face in some direction. So who knows what that bear is experiencing? Who knows if it's like, wow, what a beautiful vista, or if it's just thinking,
yeah,
where's my next meal? You know, where's my next mating opportunity? It's just really hard and impossible to know. And that's one of my favorite things about wildlife, is that there are questions we can't answer. And there's this mystery that's still there. And I hope we never have the ability to know what a bear is thinking, because that would kind of ruin it for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I do tend to think that like they're not individuated in the same way that we are, again, aside from like domestic animals, but they might be individuated in some way or in some like in some sense, but the way it takes being able to sort of think about your emotions and feelings would make it very different from the way we're individuated. And so it'd be very hard to actually relate to animals. There's that like a Wittgenstein quote, which is like, if a lion could speak, we couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, or we wouldn't understand it. It's actually not, the experience actually isn't translatable, because it's a completely different way of being. But again, there are animals that seem to sort of cross that threshold, but it's not most of them, you know. Well, it definitely isn't most of them, because most of them are beetles, but it's not most of them, you know? So, yeah, I mean, on the one hand, yes, I totally agree. And I think you're pretty consistent about like not anthropomorphizing to the point where it actually is more than just shorthand. Because I mean, we do anthropomorphize just for shorthand, like just to, because it's too hard to talk around totally. That all the time. But on the other hand, like there are instances where it does happen, and I'm always like interested in where we can't shake it. So like when you were talking, for instance, about, I think it was dolphins or whales, like forcing sex on the other, on their mates. And that is, I don't know, like akin to rape basically. And I had, it's the guy who basically just popularized, knowledge of whale song, and he came and spoke to my seminar, and he was just like, went on and on about the whales, like raping the females and how horrible it was. And so it's interesting to me that, like, I mean, obviously I'm not advocating for that in human beings, but it's interesting right. to me the certain things that we can't really break through, or that we default on, and like we immediately like anthropomorphize. And I saw that come up in your show. It's not a critique really, or criticism.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously if I'm saying the main whale scientist like ever did it, like it's understandable, yeah. but it's interesting to me the times that we can't untangle ourselves from it,
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think there's times where it's almost impossible for us to like separate ourselves from our experience when we're reflecting that on animals. I do think there's instances, you bring up this forced mating. There's instances where there's very clear cues from the recipient that they're not excited about what's happening. There's like violence, or there's vocalization. There's different things that people that have researched these animals their whole lives and know their behaviors know that, that female or that male or whoever might be the unwilling participant isn't happy, And I think you're right. Like, I think it has to end there when you make those comparisons. You have to say, this is an unwilling recipient of this mating attempt, and they're not excited about it. But I think if you start to then say, what kind of trauma, psychological, physical, whatever, physical, I think we can get a lot closer to detailing, but like, then you're overstepping. Then you really are anthropomorphizing to a level where it's becoming very human, and we're starting to reflect our own values and whatnot on that species. And maybe that's the only way that that species perpetuates, maybe every single time there's a mating opportunity, it's that way. And unfortunately, that's just their natural history. And I think if we start to make judgment calls about those sort of things and say that it's violent and evil or whatever, then we're overstepping. But I do think we can say this is very unpleasant for that female animal,
Yeah.
And I think that's okay. Yeah. And that's like where we kind of need to leave it as scientists at least. But I speaking on that whole topic, I do think the pendulum is swung a little bit too far sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. Like, yeah.
not anthropomorphizing.
Yeah.
And saying like even in some of my studies, we would assign bears names because it's just easier to keep them, categorized. If I know like, oh, this bear is Homer, this bear is Bart, this bear is Marge, those sort of things.
Where'd you get those names from?
and there would be scientists that would say, no, this bear is A65-C, And it's like, come on, man, does it really have to be that hard? Like, do we really have to make it that level of scientific? Because yes. sometimes it does help to anthropomorphize a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, that's also in some ways just another form of anthropomorphization. I know that most scientists wouldn't agree with that statement, but I mean, we're trying to arrange information in a way that helps us understand something. And if we apply, something that is like, if we apply what is a very human quantitative model, in fact, probably like almost uniquely human quantitative scientific model over something, like, then that is, I know that that's not giving it human features exactly, but it's designating in our minds like a very human quality whenever we see that organism, instead of letting
totally.
It live, And well,
it also constrains it to a specific language where, then when you produce a paper about that animal and you write it in that language and you don't anthropomorphize at all, that knowledge is then only accessible to scientists, because any person that doesn't understand the way that those things are written and interpreted will pick up that paper and it's just numbers and figures, and it's really hard to interpret and absorb. And I do think that's a problem in academia, is that that often it's just kind of a circle jerk of like, I've produced this paper for other scientists, they're going to look at that paper, but it's not ever going to disseminate into the popular, you know, world, because it's just not accessible to those people, both in the way that it's written and the way that it's stored. So I do think that's an issue. And that's a big role of the podcast too, is to kind of try and bring some of that more scientific literature into a way that people can digest it.
I mean, I'm, you know, again, that's also just one method of science. I mean, obviously I have a great respect for science, but even as you and I were talking about a different kind of natural history that was practiced in the, you know, early 20th century, it's definitely doesn't seem like that's better for getting results on some sort of molecular level, or maybe doing like artificial insemination of species to preserve them, or whatever it might be. But it was good at certain other things. And part of it, I think, is, you know, if we could somehow retain the feeling level there and bring it into science without corrupting the data, that might be helpful. I mean, I also think it's like, why is it so threatening to name the bear or to remark on your relationship to it or your feelings about it, as long as you separate it out when you, even if you include it in the paper, as long as you separate it out? Because like, if you really can define where the line is between your feeling and the data, then it shouldn't be threatening to actually include that in some of your processes. Yeah.
Unfortunately though, that's just not right now. That's not the standard. You know, if you do include that stuff in your work, it's often looked down on. So.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's like, that might be a problem that I have with how science is practiced now. Generally, you know, I studied for a while at this place called the Nature Institute in New York State, and they used a different method of science. It was called Goethean science, based on like Goethe's methods. And a big part of that was, when you look at something and a feeling or a thought arises in you, that actually is also data. It's not the same kind of data, but if you just completely exclude that from how you're viewing the phenomena or accepting or receiving the phenomena, you really are losing something. Because when does that not exist? I mean, some weird, like, well, I'll enter into this completely Zen sort of state of altered consciousness to do science where, you know, I don't exist. And then that's where all the data will come from. It can produce really worthwhile results, but it doesn't actually give, in some ways it gives completely inaccurate results in its own weird way, outside of what, you know, kind of technology or invention can come out of it.
Yeah, we're emotional animals. So I do think that, I think it plays a big part in the way that we observe and see the world. And I do tend to agree with that there needs to be more of it in science.
Yeah, don't worry, I won't push you to challenge the scientific method on my podcast. No, and then you'll just get really
it's all right. At this point, the podcast is kind of my main thing. So I can kind of take a step to the side and look at the science part of my career and poke some holes in it.
Well, then maybe that can be sort of the last thing we talk about here, because I want to know if that has led you then. It was just a really interesting thing that you just said. I mean, I was making the joke earlier that you're able to sort of fund your wildlife biologist like habit, you know, or hobby with your podcast job now. You have a lot more freedom to reflect on these things than a lot of scientists who are really strictly bound for their entire livelihood to institutions are. So you must, you might feel more freedom to have some critiques. And I'm wondering if you want to share any of them.
I think my main, you know, I agree with what you just said. I think I've been so lucky in my career to have a portion of it that was really dedicated to research, a portion that was really dedicated to management, and now a portion that I'm in that's really dedicated to outreach. And I think those are really the three pillars of wildlife biology. Those are the three necessary things to preserving wild populations. And I'm lucky that I've been able to participate in all three. I think management's the one that gives me the most kind of thrill and vitality and everything. It's just working with animals in close proximity and kind of trying to reduce conflict on the ground is what I'm the most passionate about. But education, I think, is the thing that has had the most impact for my career so far. Mm. I've produced a number of papers. They've kind of sat on the shelf. They've been cited a number of times, but they're not the things that I'm the most proud of. The thing that I'm the most proud of is the podcast. And that's because we've been able to reach hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, and teach them real world lessons about wildlife and give them a deeper appreciation of things that they might see out in the wilderness. And for me, then, to answer your question, I think there's still this, I have a soft spot for the science part of it, the research part of it. And I think, you know, there's so many things that we've learned because of the scientific method when it comes to wildlife. But I think the things that I see happening sometimes are it being very exclusive. We mentioned that already, both in the way that things are written, the way that things are stored, even just the process itself of submitting a paper costs money, and they're often under paywalls and all of that. It's kind of like this ivory tower that people have access to, but everyone else in the world just has to kind of get their science through, you know, news media or whatever. And I don't like that. I think that's a huge issue. And then I think a lot of biologists that haven't had the opportunity that I've had can get really myopic in the way that they view the world and their research and everything, because maybe they're working with the same species their entire life, or they're working with the same organization, and those goals of that organization just become their, like, the only thing that they think about. And I think that can happen in any field, any kind of job, but I do think it's unfortunate. I think it's the reason we often have people that just dig their heels in on things and can't look at the world in a different way. And so that would be my main thing. But overall, I'm a huge fan of science and the scientific process and everything, or the scientific method. And but I do think there are some flaws that need to be confronted.
Yeah, like, I didn't think you'd be like a juggalo and like say that you were just completely
magnets. What the fuck?
Yeah. He's wearing the makeup, though, people, just for those of you who can't see it. But I mean, it's all, like, I think it's all important. And I think it's actually really, I mean, as someone who tells story, like, you're, you know, really a storyteller, like, at this point, you know, it's like, it sounds like the main part of your, part of, you know, the actual work day is, like, you know, compiling and then telling a story. And, you know, I don't want to, to me, that's like a really complimentary thing to say. So I hope that doesn't sound pejorative when I say that to you, you know. But that's,
I will say, I will say, like, and you're probably getting at this, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think something that just came to me that I do think is the most important skill that I learned as I was learning how to become a scientist. It's not like it was learning how to operate our stats program or learning how to, you know, understand the movement patterns of grizzly bears. The thing that was the most important to me as a scientist, and the thing that I brought into the podcast, and you say, like, you know, I'm primarily a storyteller. I think the thing that I bring is that I'm a storyteller that knows how to sniff out bullshit. And as in my studies, that's what I learned, is how to research. You know, how to pull out sources that I can trust and how to recognize ones that I can't. And that's really important when you're talking about life and death things, is, you know, knowing how to get good information. And it's something the world is missing right now, like, at large, is it's really tricky to sniff out bullshit. And I think that's the number one skill that I learned that has made me an effective storyteller and podcaster when it comes to wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, this is such a great place to kind of wind down here, because I also, you know, I often say that like my science education, the best thing it did was teach me how to interpret and critique science properly, because mm-hmm. I mean, I have this podcast that's like mostly, you know, I would say my audience is basically people with leftist politics and spiritual people. And sometimes there's some overlap between those two. And a lot of times both of those groups, but mostly the spiritual people now, can be like highly dismissive of science. And I'm fine for like all those critiques, but I want them to be the right ones. And I want them also to be able to apply a kind of scientific mind to like their spiritual impulses or their, you know, or their, the way in which they form, you know, their political ideas, not like through evolutionary psychology or whatever. But, and I think that like, so what I hear you saying is like, well, look, I want to tell true stories. Like, and when I tell them, you know, they're true because they have the right information, sure, but I'm also able to call myself out when I don't know something. And I'm also able to bring, you know, feeling to it and respect the people that are involved. And that brings a different dimension of truth to it as well. And so like really like having that ability to just sort of suss out where the limits of knowledge here and where should I limit, you know, where I make the joke, or where should I limit where I offer the advice and everything. I mean, such being able to have that almost like negative, see the negative space that you shouldn't really like go into or push into, that is like a science skill. And I think that that's a pretty profound way to look at what you're doing on the podcast, is to be like, yeah, it's about actually not including too much bullshit. But the flip side of that is like, you get to say the true thing. And that's really, right. Yeah. Like, that's why it's so exciting, I think, to me, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, plus Jeff's really funny, but you know, and Mike's very funny.
Yeah. I think Mike's the funniest person I've ever met in my life. That dude cracks me up so much. But I think that's it exactly. And we definitely mess up sometimes. We definitely get things, we overstep at times, or we get things wrong. But my goal is, if I don't know something, not to pretend like I know it. You know, if I feel like I don't have a good source or I don't have a good base for saying something on the podcast, I try and just say, you know what, I'm not sure. Like, this is something we don't know, or we don't understand, or I don't understand. And I think that's okay. I don't think people that are disseminating information about a specific topic need to be the end all, you know, source for that topic. If you ever have someone like that, I'm immediately really dubious.
Yeah, totally.
because it's not true, you know, and even with science, like the thing that I love about it is that we're constantly changing it and rearranging how we think about things. And some people see that as a weakness, and I see that as its main strength, that we can look back and say, you know what, we were wrong about this. And now we have this new data that shows that maybe it's this, you know, but we're not sure still. and I love that. And I love that that it is this constantly evolving place for our brains to go. And I'm really happy that I get to speak about the thing that I'm most passionate about, which is wildlife human conflict and how we can coexist with these animals that we've pretty much pushed out of every natural space in the world. And it's really exhilarating for me to have that kind of pedestal.
Yeah, well, I mean, you picked a topic, which means that you have a podcast about something that's going to become increasingly relevant, which is very rare for a podcast, you know, like, which is animal-human interaction. Most people's podcasts, first of all, don't need to exist at all. But second of all, like, if they do, they're like diminishing returns. Unfortunately, yours is more and more relevant each day. So
totally. We're also giving people information to like reduce the amount of content that we get, which is like, we're kind of killing ourselves in that way, where I'm like, you know what? You should do all these things to avoid a bear attack, but maybe you should just get attacked, because then we can tell your story.
Exactly. You just actually give like the highest members of your Patreon a special emergency cell phone that, you know,
exactly.
You give them a pathway, and then you're like, just call us when it happens, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's great having you on, and thank you for like giving me a podcast that I love listening to. I mean, that's so few and far between for me. And I'm like every week, like you'd think I would get tired of it, but it's like, sex or donuts. Like every time I'm like, this is great. So thank you so much, Wes.
That'll be our new tagline on the podcast is it's like sex or donuts. No, I'm really glad you love it. And thank you for the conversation. I truly, you know, we've been doing this thing for about 4 years now, and I'm still not tired of talking about animals. Like I just, I can do it all day. I love any opportunity to talk about them. So appreciate diving into some of the nitty gritty with you. That was fun.
Thanks, man. And all right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Bye now.